here. All right, it is that time.
Slam the door in anyone's face.
So I was going to start with some stuff on the paper, because obviously that's coming due, but I will hold off. Give some other people a chance to remember, oh yeah, school's back in session. I actually got to go to class. Give them a chance to arrive. Right? Right?
Right.
See, I knew it. All right, so while we're waiting, I will do a little bit of a review, because I realized I was kind of click, 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 click at the end of the class. So I'll come back and revisit what I covered and what I didn't cover that I should have covered, but I ran out of time in this blurb. So just as a reminder, if you recall, we were mentioning how Japan was locked down. The Tokugawa shogunate basically banned any outsiders from coming in other than the Dutch. And it was during that time that Japanese intellectuals started trying to figure out what type of country they wanted. Because they knew there was a world outside of Japan, and they didn't quite know how to deal with the world outside of Japan. They definitely heard stories about what was going on in the Asian trade network, and how first the Portuguese, and then later the Dutch, and the English, and the French. They heard from the Chinese all that was going on. And it became concerning. And by the way, the period of lockdown is loosely covered in Shogun, which is on Hulu. You know, it's been, it's not factual, it's a story, but it's been excellent. If any of you are interested in Japanese culture during the samurai period. But, anyways, during this period, the intellectuals kind of had a debate. Intellectually, they had embraced Neo-Confucianism, which, of course, was Chinese in nature. And in Neo-Confucianism, it had all of the elements of regular Confucianism that we talked about. And the Japanese themselves were troubled by this. Now, of course, the Japanese liked some, or at least the Tokugawa, liked some of the ideas that came from Confucianism, such as filial piety, you know, the notion that there are people above you and you must obey those people. You had rigidity in society where everyone was locked into place, wherever they may sit. But of course, there were people questioning the way the Tokugawa were doing things. So two schools of thought appeared. One of which was, I guess you could call, the conservative reaction, the Kokugaku. This was the school of national learning. Of course, it wasn't a school, and it was more nationalistic in nature, in which they argued that the way to advance is to by looking into the past to try to figure out what is Japanese, what makes the Japanese unique, and emphasize that. So get rid of the Chinese and focus only on the way their ancestors used to do it. Then there was a more modernist perspective, the Rangaku, Dutch schools. Of course, as I threw out real quick, this school appeared when Dutch books, particularly books on medicine, started appearing. And the intellectuals in this school started saying, look at the primitive books we got from the Chinese that talks about humors and balances and putting rocks to try to holistically heal your energy versus the European medical books that actually had detailed renderings of what the inside of a human body looked. And these thinkers started saying, well, maybe we can learn from the Europeans. So not to be conquered by the Europeans, not to embrace everything about the Europeans, but just taking the best. So there was this debate. But in the end, the average Japanese person was kind of a little bit of both. They embraced their past while embracing the best they could get from the Europeans. But of course, there were tensions, as there always are, between conservatives and, I guess you could say, liberals. Always are tensions. But only in Japan did the two factions have more in common than they had in opposition. So in our country, we don't have liberals anymore. Liberals are gone. All you have is progressives, which are basically socialists. And they compete against conservatives, who I guess you could say technically are the classical liberals. You know, the socialists want to change society from top to bottom, whereas the conservatives like society and want to keep it the way it's been. You know, there's very little common ground between the two ideologies. But in Japan, so do we only look to the past or we embrace some new things? Both of them realized Japan is unique, so we have to embrace some tradition. And both also wanted to protect their nation above all else. Oh, there you go. I'll use a political one because we're in election year. So the conservatives largely embrace Make America Great. You know, that's a nationalist make focus on America's issues alone, whereas the Democrats tend to be anti-American. Well, here both were saying no, Japan. Japan, Japan, Japan. And neither faction despised their traditional religion, nor did they despise the emperor. So, just to kind of fast forward, you want to know why the Japanese during World War II were willing to get in planes and fly them into American battleships, killing their lives? It's because of this. They're fighting to preserve their country against those who are seeking to destroy it. Because it all bases or ties itself back to here. All right. A little bit of a review, but a little bit of a launching point. Any questions on any of that? All right. So now you have these ideas being bantied about. And an idea is just an idea until something appears to challenge those ideas. And as long as Japan was isolated, neither side would gain traction. But in the midst of this, in the midst of the economic problems that I talked about last class, there would be a direct challenge to the way the Japanese had been existing for 200 years. But the weird thing is like I said, they knew it was coming. They knew it was coming. At the end of the 18th century, the late 1780s, 1790s, there were Japanese authors talking about the real, foreseeable, and potential dangers that were just beyond the horizon. They were terrified over what they were hearing, again, through the Chinese, about what the Dutch were doing in Indonesia, or what the English were doing in India, slowly taking over economies. And they were terrified. But they didn't know what to do about it. There were actually some suggestions that Japan should build a strong navy and use it to defend their home island, not to let the outsiders come in. But ultimately, this was just talk. Nothing was done. But the fear was there. Until July 8th, 1853, when their nightmares became a reality. On this day, an American squadron of four steamships commanded by Commodore Matthew Perry arrived in Edo Bay, a body of water that's 30 miles away from the capital. Commodore Perry had orders from the President of these United States, one of the most popular presidents of all time, Millard Fillmore. Ever hear of Millard Fillmore? Sarcastic in that regard. This is really the only thing that he accomplished during his presidency. He opened up Japan. But anyways, that's getting ahead of myself. So Fillmore orders Perry to essentially make a treaty with Japan similar to some of the uneven treaties that they're forcing on China. In other words, open up the country to trade. They wanted to have access to Japan as being a jumping point. They wanted to have the right to pull American ships into Japanese harbors, get fresh waters, food, supplies, and so forth. Now, ironically, this was a picture that was painted by a Japanese artist as he's looking out into the bay. They had never seen a steamship before. Yes, they had paddle wheels on it. They had a steam engine that had a smokestack that billowed black smoke. The Japanese actually thought that these ships were powered by volcanoes. And that's what this print suggests, that this is a demon vessel powered by volcanoes. Well, for 5 days, the Japanese engaged in what could be considered stereotypical Japanese negotiation techniques. The Japanese have a funny way of seemingly negotiating in good faith, but giving absolutely nothing. And just engaging in delay, delay, delay. The biggest thing was that Perry was under orders to meet with a direct representative of the emperor. The reason being is the American had no idea how the shogun system worked, where the emperor wasn't the actual ruler, that the emperor was more like the pope, that he was a semi-divine son of the goddess of creation. So when representatives of the shogun arrived, he thought he was meeting with representatives of the commanding general of an army. This made no sense to him. Well, the Japanese, of course, said, no, these are the people you want to talk to. And he kept saying, no, this is not who I want to talk to. He went so far as to threaten that he would sail into the coast and bombard, open fire upon the coastline if he didn't get his way. He refused to move the ships out of the harbor. He refused to accept any Japanese gifts. And most importantly, he didn't let them come on board. But then on July 14th, an unprecedented event occurred, which would be one of the first steps in overturning the shogunate. Two imperial princes arrived. Word had reached Kyoto. Word had reached the imperial court of the presence of these two. So, these princes appeared out of nowhere, and they met with Perry. But they didn't give Perry what he wanted. But instead, they took what Perry had to say under advisement. Does anyone know what that phrase means? No one's ever heard of that before. So it's like, I hear what you're saying, but that's it. So you acknowledge that words were shared, but there is no response to it. Which, of course, infuriated Perry. But rather than provoking a war, he promised that he would return. FYI, the United States was, as we know, playing catch up in the war, and the Second Opium War was going on. So Perry's ships actually sailed to China to help out when they basically threatened to blow up Beijing. So he was gone for about a year. Now, while Perry was gone, a series of bad events occurred. The first of which was the death of the shogun. Tokugawa Ieyoshi had been shogun for 20 years. And then he died 2 months after Perry departed. Now, the shogunate is a hereditary position. It does pass father to son. But Ieyoshi had 4 sons. So the council had to decide which one they were going to put on the throne. And they debated for about 4 months before they made a decision. Now, when it occurred during this gap where there is no shogun, and again, the shogun is the executive. He's the person who's in charge. Some of his counselors, some of the staff, decided to see if they could resolve this Perry issue. So, in something that had never ever occurred during the entirety of the 200 plus years of the Tokugawa shogunate, the council sent a document to all of the daimyo. Not just the ones that were related to the shogun. Not just the ones that were friendly to the shogun. But all of them. And basically did an opinion poll. What should we do about this? Now, at this time, there were 59 of them that were the powerful ones. In total, there were about 300. But the vast majority of the daimyo were insignificant. But of the 59 players, the ones who actually had armies, all 59 responded. And I love their response. 22 said we should begin trading with the Americans. Only because we cannot defend ourselves against the American Navy. But, as we trade, we should learn from the Americans, get their technology, get their weapons, and then use it on them and drive them away. 18 said, okay, we're not going to fully trade with the Americans. We'll do just a little bit. Because we need time to build up our military response to drive the Americans away. And then there were 19 hardliners, including the powerful Satsuma and Choshu clans, who we're going to talk about in a little bit. And they said, no concessions. Let's just kill the Americans. Let's just drive them away. So long story short, all 59 of them, in the end, were at the same point. No Americans. War. To protect Japan. It was just a matter of how long it would take. That is a classic example of what I was saying up here. It's all about protecting Japan, protecting the emperor at all costs. Now, of course, this was an unbinding resolution. The daimyo's opinions had no impact on what was decided, but it was significant because these are the other powerful warlords that are in Japan. And like I said, 59 of them all had armies. Now, fast forward to February 11th, 1854. Perry returns. This time he has 8 ships. The representatives of the emperor came back, and they decided, after speaking with the shogun, the new shogun, and his advisors, to accept the minimum amount of American demands. So instead of opening up all trade or opening up none, they went with the middle. They signed a treaty in March, and they would open up 2 ports to American vessels. They allowed the Americans to provision so they could get food, they could get fresh water, but they were not allowed to send Americans into Japan. So they could have a consul in a port city, but Americans were not to leave that city. Now, of course, just like what happened in China, the moment one gets one, all the other European nations jump in, like sharks to chum. And soon the Brits, the Russians, the Dutch would all win similar rights. 2 ports, could get fresh water, could get fresh food, could have consulate, could have an American or a British or a Russian official there, but they couldn't leave the port. All right. Questions? Well, because they opened the can of worms, the moment these deals were signed, all of the daimyo began asking questions, like, why the hell are we doing this? And in the end, the response that the shogunate gave was, we have no alternative. We heeded the advice of the emperor. We tried doing the middle ground. We have no choice. Why? One, the West has these steamships. They have firearms. At this point, they're armed with rifles. They have cannon. They can kill lots of people. While the samurai were effective warriors, a sword versus a gun. Who wins? It's gun every time. Every time. So the shogun responded, look, I know you guys are mad, but we had no choice. They could kill us, and we don't want to be killed. Plus, there were many, many advocates of the Dutch school who were arguing that the Japanese should learn from the barbarians, from the Gaijin. Gaijin, Japanese for foreigner and enemy. So, if we can learn from them, we can take the best from them, and we can use it to our advantage. Now, FYI, even though the emperor's advisors were knowledgeable of the initial deal, as word reached the emperor, Kome, that the shogun is now signing treaty after treaty with barbarian nation after barbarian nation, he himself sent word to the shogun that he was not pleased. He was a hardcore conservative, fully believed in the School of National Learning. He was 100% anti-foreigner. He did not believe the Japanese could learn anything of value from the Gaijin. So, word of this reached the daimyo. And soon, some of the daimyo basically began deciding, we're not going to follow the rules. Instead of going to the shogun as the rules dictate, we're going to skip the shogun and we're going to go right to the emperor. And we're going to hopefully get the emperor to make decisions. Now again, what's the big deal? Simple. The Japanese emperors have not been rulers. They've not been in charge and actually making political and legal decisions for 1,000 years. So for all sakes and purposes, this is unprecedented. You have a shogun who looks weak, you have daimyo who are not going to follow the weak guy, and then you have an alternative. Questions? And this begins a period of revolution, which the Japanese called the Bakumatsu. The Bakumatsu, which is the end of the shogunate, the end of the shogun system. From 1853 until 1868, the Tokugawa regime slowly begins to die. And some of the other daimyo began to arise as not alternatives, but advocates for destroying the system. And of course, what was triggering it was these daimyo, some of them, were just absolutely furious over the presence of these foreigners. Because the foreigners had different customs, different values than the Japanese. And this infuriated the Japanese. For example, the United States had a treaty with Japan that was signed in February of 1854, the Treaty of Kanagawa. 2 years later, the U.S. consul, the chief American diplomat in Japan, began pushing for a new treaty that would, for instance, give Americans extraterritorial rights. You know, the same thing they got out of China. Began demanding more ports of treaty. Began demanding access to the interior by missionaries. All trying to put pressure on the Japanese so the Americans could do to the Japanese what everyone was doing to the Chinese. Now, when Harris submitted his proposal to the shogun, the shogun, the new shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, would do something again, not to be cliche, but it was unprecedented. Something that had never occurred in the history of the Tokugawa shogunate. He wasn't sure what to do. He already gave in to the Americans once. But what happens when you give in to a child? When you go to the grocery store who starts crying for candy and you give the child that piece of candy? What's going to happen with that child the next time you go to the grocery store? I'm sure all of you did it. All of you were spoiled when you were kids, right? Spoiled rotten. Hey, mommy, get me candy! I know how my mother would handle it. Shut the... Smack. Well, Aes Sedai, he didn't know what to do. He realized we're experiencing what today we call the snowball effect. If you give them a little, they're going to come back and they're going to want more. And then if you give to that, then they're going to want more. And then if you give into that, they're going to want more. So what should I do? So what does he do? He sends his counselors to the emperor and asks the emperor what he thinks. Again, I just want to repeat, this is the first time any shogun, and by the way, I believe he's the 12th, so 200 plus years, the first time any shogun contacted any of the emperors and asked their opinion on anything. Now, Aes Sedai had actually hoped that the emperor would agree with him, that it's better just to give to the Americans what they want this time, and then we'll deal with the consequences. Because Aes Sedai was trying to do the balancing game with the daimyo. But the emperor did not sanctify or sanction the treaty. He said it didn't protect Japan's honor, that it was humiliating, and that he was opposed to it. Well, when word got back to the shogun, he was even in more of a tizzy. What do I do? If I sign it now, the emperor's going to be mad at me. Well, unfortunately for the kid, his advisors said just to sign the treaty, which he did. And then shortly thereafter, he would be forced to sign another one with the Brits. Now, Japan was open. Missionaries could enter Japan, travel freely throughout Japan, which eventually ends the isolation. But now imagine for me this. Strangers in a strange land. Now you have Americans, and you have Brits, and you have French and Dutch, all walking around through Japanese towns at a time when the samurai were still present. Unfortunately, this would result in violence because the samurai would not tolerate this insult. In direct response to the emperor's refusal to allow for the opening of Japan, a movement would begin. Sonojoi. Sonojoi. This simple Japanese phrase means revere the emperor, expel the barbarians. Revere the emperor, expel the barbarians. Japan would move to go the route that China did during the Boxer Rebellion. Leading this movement were some of the most powerful clans in Japan. The Mito, the Satsuma, and the Choshu. Their daimyo, their allies started formulating plans and were moving closer to rebellion against the shogun. Now, the shogun, of course, being the military dictator, would attempt to suppress these rebellions. They famously sent their armies against the Mito, M-I-T-O. And they would defeat them completely on the battlefield. And then the Mito would be humiliated. Their chief daimyo would be stripped of all his lands. Other clan leaders would be arrested. Some would be exiled. Some would be executed. The shogunate had the power to make an example out of these people. But in the midst of it, the emperor publicly decries not the Mito for going against the shogun, but he publicly decries the shogun. He declares that the shogun should work with the emperor for the good of Japan. Now, by the way, put on the news and see what's happening in some of the big cities in our country where the police are arresting criminals, but the district attorneys are just letting them out. Do you think that's going to stop the criminals from committing crimes? No, it only emboldens them. They only do something worse the next time. Look, we had the New York cop that was murdered by a felon who had like 30 felony charges in his record. Each one systematically worse. By the emperor coming out and basically telling the shogun to not do his job, this would result in violence. For example, not that you need to remember this, 1860, March, samurai from the Mito and the Satsuma enacted revenge for what occurred to the Mito. They actually captured one of the leading advisors to the shogun, the man who actually signed the treaty with Harrison, and cut his head off on the street. More and more isolated incidents occurred. There were stories that Christian missionaries were being accosted. Things were spiraling out of control. And then if that wasn't bad enough, in December of 1960, cholera outbreak occurred. A pandemic in which over 200,000 would die in Edo alone, the capital city. The shogun himself lost his life. Now, FYI, the Japanese sat back and said, "We never had cholera before, but what happened? These foreigners appear." And they kind of put two and two together, that it was the foreigners that brought the disease to their land. Well, when that occurred, groups of samurai began attacking not only Christian missionaries, but Westerners wherever they found them. Merchants, bakufu, government officials, shogun officials, anyone. Even Japanese merchants who did business with the Westerners were all being accosted. Two British diplomats were caught, got their heads cut off, and they actually killed Townsend Harris's interpreter, almost killing the American ambassador. And of course, that's what the shogun do. They will cut your head off. They take out their katanas, and with a quick slice, you've lost your head. And under Japanese law, if a samurai does it, it's not murder, because samurai legally cannot commit murder. But then, as if all of that wasn't bad enough, an international event occurred. International in that it was covered in all of the newspapers across the world. In 1863, a British merchant by the name of Charles Richardson was murdered on the streets when he had the audacity to ride his horse across a street on which the daimyo from Satsuma was marching. FYI, under Japanese custom, when a daimyo and his procession is marching down the street, everybody gets out of the way. The streets are emptied. But the fact that this British merchant just went across on a horse, his samurai would get him, drag him off of his horse, and kill him. Well, the Brits responded. Several Japanese cities along the Satsuma coast were attacked by British vessels. They sailed close, opened fire. Things were completely out of control. Japan was on the verge of a war with the foreigners, which triggered another unprecedented event. Pictured here is Tokugawa Omochi. He would be chosen upon the death of his father. He was just a teenager. When news of what occurred with Richardson and the British response occurred, he would actually travel to Kyoto, enter the palace of the emperor. The first time a shogun had entered the palace since Tokugawa Ieyasu was chosen to be shogun, and met with Kome. And this meeting allowed the emperor to break the tradition of doing nothing, of being a figurehead. Instead, he would take action. He told the shogun he opposed all of the treaties that had been signed by his father. And actually would go so far as to declare whether or not Omochi was fit to be shogun. Maybe we should get you out and get somebody else instead. Humiliated, Omochi would leave and would go back to Edo. But a week and a half later, the emperor would actually issue an order to the people of Japan. This is an order for the Japanese to rise up and expel the barbarians. Now, when the shogun got this order, even though he was a kid, he realized, I'm not going to do this. Because one British ship leveled an entire Japanese town. If an army of these barbarians landed, the shogun realized they could just march across Japan. They could destroy everything in their path. He did not want to risk that. So instead, passively resisted the emperor's orders and refused to enforce it. So now the shogun's doing nothing, the emperor is saying that the shogun should do something, and things just continue to spiral out of control. For example, the Choshu managed to have primitive cannons, and they move these cannons down to the shoreline. And whenever a French or a Dutch or an American ship would sail by, they'd open fire. Well, Westerners then responded by sending naval vessels and they began basically blowing stuff off along the coast of the Choshu territories. Tit for tat. Push became a shove. Everything spiraling out of control, resulting in a civil war known as the Boshin War. This war was a civil war in which the Japanese fought against the Japanese. But it was not a war. But it was not a war against the emperor. It was a war against the shogun and the shogun's allies. It was triggered when a group of Choshu samurai marched from their homelands. Oh, go back. No spoilers. Would march from their homelands and would try to make their way to the capital city of Kyoto. They attempted to basically kidnap the emperor. Now, they were not trying to hold the emperor hostage. No, they were trying to free the emperor from the Tokugawa's control. Well, forces that were loyal to the Tokugawa fought back, and they managed to prevent the Choshu from getting to Kyoto. But men died on both sides. And then a weird thing happened. The enemy of my enemy became my friend. Now, traditionally, the Satsuma and the Choshu did not get along with one another. But both of them realized that the shogun was a worse threat. Both were angered over the foreign concessions. Both had long been rivals against Tokugawa. And they decided that their rivalry against each other was insignificant to that individual. The interesting thing was that they used the emperor's refusal to enforce, the shogun's refusal to enforce the emperor's will as justification. So again, think of the nationalist school. They're not rebelling against the emperor. They are rebelling for the emperor. They are rebelling to save Japan. Really bizarre. So let me think. The civil war that you're probably most familiar with is the U.S. Civil War. And obviously, 11 southern states seceded from the Union. The southern states, when they seceded, claimed that they were seceding for their own rights. They were looking to protect their own rights. States' rights. Which included, of course, the right to have slavery. But they weren't doing it to save the country, they were doing it to save themselves. But here, you have a bunch of revolutionaries rebelling to save the country. Really bizarre. And to make matters worse, they embraced the Dutch school. They managed to get their hands on surplus U.S. Civil War rifles. Because by 1865, the U.S. Civil War was over. Guess what every single country does when a war ends? They sell off their military weapons. So, the Satsuma managed to get their hands on crates and crates and crates of U.S. Civil War rifles. Now, there were some guns in Japan prior to this, but the guns were based on the model that they got from the Dutch 250 years ago. So there were still the smoothbore, muzzle-loading, matchlock rifles. But notice what they got here. I don't know if you can see the picture. They got breech-loading rifles. So instead of having to ram the bullet down, you open a trap door and you push your bullet in. These were the guns that the Union used to smash the Confederacy. And what's the advantage of guys with guns versus guys with swords? It takes years and years and years to become effective with a sword. It takes about a 15-minute lesson to know how to fire a gun. So the Satsuma suddenly could basically take any. You didn't just have to be samurai. You could take anybody. Train them up, put a gun in their hand, and now they're an effective soldier. Proof of this came in 1866. 1866 was a bad year for the shogunate. And it explains why it was almost dead. The shogun died. Yoshinobu, who was his successor, was capable. But again, he becomes shogun in the midst of a civil war. The rebels were winning battle after battle after battle. Heck, any of you ever see the Tom Cruise movie, Last Samurai? Technically, The Last Samurai happened after this, but that is a good example of the type of things that were happening. And ironically, the effectiveness of the Western weapons made many people in Japan realize, maybe we're not superior. Maybe we should give up some of our traditions and learn from the enemy. Questions? Now that's not to say that the new shogun did not try. He attempted to fix things through, ironically, diplomacy. He, for example, proposed making something like a constitutional monarchy, similar to what England has, where the emperor would become the national leader. But the shogun would be like the prime minister. And apparently, there were some that were willing to agree to this. This is a good compromise. It's going to stop the war. It's going to stop the violence. It's going to stop the death. Bloodshed. But like some of the other reform efforts we talked about, particularly the ones in China, even this would fail. Because of fate. On January 30th, 1867, in the midst of the Civil War, in the midst of trying to negotiate a way out of it, the emperor dies. Of smallpox. like cholera, another disease that had never been present in Japan before the coming of the Westerners. When the emperor died, it was believed the foreigners were to be blamed. So now what do? This would force the shogun's hand. And it would also force the hand of the daimyo. Because as the Choshu and the Satsuma were rolling over everybody, many of the daimyo began thinking, okay, you had the shogun who was trying to come up with a compromise versus potentially being destroyed by the Satsuma and the Choshu, who are crazy. To make matters worse, the new emperor, he's just a kid, 16 years old, Meiji. So this forced the majority of the daimyo to take action. They did the lesser of two evils. Is the shogun perfect? No. But the Satsuma and the Choshu were worse. So, upon the ascension of Meiji, the majority of the daimyo began basically saying the only way to end this war, the only way to bring Japan together, is to basically strip the political power from the shogun and give it to the emperor. Because no one is going to question the emperor, because the emperor is a living god. Now, granted, they weren't going to let the emperor rule. They were going to put a council around him, and the council would be filled with all the powerful daimyo. But instead of having one daimyo, the shogun rule, you're going to bring in a bunch. Well, by 1867, when everything is spiraling out of control, in the end, even the shogun would agree to this. Yoshinobu, the last shogun of Japan, would surrender his authority to the emperor. He would go back to mere daimyo status. Questions? Well, when word of this occurred, the rebels quickly jumped on it. And they would declare, this is the reason we've been fighting. We were seeking the restoration of the emperor. And the restoration has occurred. The 250-year reign of the Tokugawa comes to an end. Now, FYI, there was some holdouts, but even they would be destroyed. And ultimately, that is what The Last Samurai was about. Some of the other daimyo holdouts that did not want to bow down to this restoration, that sought to preserve the traditions of Japan. But if you've seen that movie, Tom Cruise movie, it's pretty good. The symbolic end to the age of the samurai came when the Japanese army there bought American surplus Gatling guns and basically mowed them all down. Although the weird thing was, and this is the one thing that bothered me about the movie more than anything, everybody else in the samurai army got ripped to shreds, except somehow Tom Cruise survived. But we'll call that plot armor. All right, questions. Almost done for the day. No questions? All right. With the restoration of the emperor as the political head of Japan, the nation would move into an unprecedented period known as the Meiji Restoration. Beginning in 1868, going all the way to 1912, the entire reign of Meiji, Japan would do the one thing that China couldn't do under the Qing, nor could the Ottoman do, or any of the other African territories that were conquered by the Westerners. They managed to adapt. They would transform themselves in a way that would allow them to not just resist the Westerners, but Japan would become, for all sakes and purposes, a Western nation. And it was all achieved through reform. Again, China wanted reform, never able to do it. The Ottomans tried reform, never able to get it all the way through. But Japan was able to make reform. Because remember, both factions wanted the same thing. Both ideological factions wanted a strong Japan and reverence of the emperor. There was no liberals versus conservatives. There was no radicals versus pacifists. Both wanted the same. Before they did a thing, samurai would be put on ships and would sail the globe, visiting nation after nation after nation. They traveled throughout Europe. They came to the United States. They enrolled in universities. They studied economics, politics, and science. In technology, they learned all that they could. Simultaneously, they extended hands of friendship to all of the foreign nations. They ended any hostility. Because the Japanese figured out something that, again, no other people that tried could. They realized the path for survival was not through fighting back, but by taking the best that the West had and making it Japanese. Classic scene that in the movie that probably none of you have ever seen. But if you ever have opportunity to do it, I highly recommend it. It was freaking hilarious. 1941. It was a movie that had like John Belushi and John Candy. The famous comedians of the 70s. But it dealt with like the chaos and the paranoia that set in the United States after Pearl Harbor was bombed. Well, there's a scene where a bunch of Japanese soldiers sneak off of a Japanese submarine, land in America, pick up an old-timey American radio. You ever see the old ones that had like the big wooden shells? And they're sitting there. They're trying to get the radio into the submarine. And they're scratching their head. They're like, we got to figure out how to make this better. And again, the meaning's probably lost on you, but when I was a kid, the Japanese began selling pieces of technology that was appearing on the stores, like Sony Walkmans and boomboxes and things like that. And they were all smaller than the American version, but they were always better. Well, that movie represented what was going on in our country at that time, but that's exactly what the Japanese did. So they looked, what do the Germans do best? What do the Italians do best? What do the Spanish do best? What do the English do best? And they took some of those ideas and they tried plugging it into the Japanese system. This would allow them to slowly strengthen their nation by avoiding any type of hostility, like could lead to the Boxer Rebellion, in which they land armies and they shoot everybody. They would act friendly. They would negotiate. They would smile, shake hands. But the goal was always the same. Learn everything they could and avoid hostility. I don't know how far I want to get. I don't know what the next click is. Oh, wait. I don't want to go to this one. We can stop a few minutes early. All right. Because there are some things I definitely got to talk about. So, we only got one class left, and then we're going to have exam number 3. That will be someday this weekend. Yes?
It says exam number 4.
No. That's wrong. Okay. That's wrong. And if that, does
I was
that
like,
say,
we didn't do 3 yet.
Yeah, but does that date, is that 2025 on the
it
exam?
It just says May 9th is the date.
All right, well, I got to
so
change it. No.
Like
oh, yeah, May 9th. Yeah, May 9th. That's the final.
But you put it on for, like, it's due next week. Like, that's, like, the slot. It
I'll change
Monday
that.
And closes
Tuesday.
No. And I was, like, really confused.
So what happens is, so what I do is I use the shell mm-hmm. of the class, and when the shell gets rolled over, it tries adapting the dates. So, your exam number 3 will be this weekend.
Okay.
But you guys get to decide when it's going to be. Would you like to take exam number 3 on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or Monday? That was chaos. Let's have a show of hands. How many people would like to take it on Friday? Nobody. How many people would like to take it on Saturday? 4 people, 5 people, 6 people. How many people would like to take it on Sunday? 6 people. Awesome. Tie. How many people would like to take it on Monday?
I think you should leave it open for the night. That way,
Saturday
everyone
and Sunday, since they got a tie.
Yeah, I just feel like that worked out for everyone last time, so why wouldn't it work again?
You can't have a tie in democracy. So you know what I'll do? I'll say we'll vote again on Thursday. No. Papers are also due. Keep in mind, this month, April 26th, we've already missed the window to get early submission extra credit. So, hopefully you're working on those and going to get them done. Because remember, your paper counts for 20% of your grade in here. And that should be an easy 20%. But the key to success is following directions. As I've told you, it's all on my website. Yeah. As I've told you, there have been papers that were submitted that grammatically were wonderful. You know, they were written really well, but they did not follow directions. And they ended up with a D or an F. Similarly, I've had papers that were just painful to read. I really thought I was reading the work of a third grader. But they followed directions, and the only thing they got wrong was the maximum grammatical penalty, which is 15 points. So they ended up with a B. So this is not about being the strongest writer. It's about being so incapable of following directions. So if you haven't read it already, go to proflamanic.com, go to the paper section, go through it top to bottom, see if there's anything you don't understand. If there's something you don't understand, bring it to class, because chances are somebody else in here probably doesn't understand what it is. Don't assume you know what it is. And try to all earn a good grade on it, all right? Cool. Have a wonderful day. I'll see you all on Thursday.